Blog Talk Radio.
This is XBN, Rocky's Broadcast Network, based in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. My name is Jill Brenneman, and tonight we have a very special guest. Her name is Carol Lee. She is affectionately known as the Scarlet Harlot, Carol Lee. She's been an activist for many, many, many years. She essentially is considered as one of the creators of the sex worker rights movement, and it is our great honor to have her on the show. Carol also has
a book
that is currently out, The Unrepentant Whore. First, Carol, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
For those who don't know, Carol Lee has been an activist for many years. Carol, my switchboard keeps playing this music. I guess it really likes this song. Trying to kill the back music as we talk. And of course, it's not working out so well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Carol?
Well, let's see. I started doing sex work in about 1977, 78, something like that, the end of 77. And I had come from a history of activism. My family were socialists back in the 30s, and there was always a lot of political discussion in my family. And I was against the war in the 60s, and I remember the first action I did was sit down for the Pledge of Allegiance in order to protest the war. In the early 70s, I became a feminist. Politics were really very much in my background, and I was also a hippie. I guess I was just, kind of that generation. And I ultimately, in the late 70s, wound up doing prostitution after many years of actually kind of trying to avoid it. As a feminist, I was concerned with that it might not be appropriate for a feminist, that it was basically supporting the patriarchy. But I was curious, and also I remember Gloria Steinem went to work for Playboy as a Playboy bunny, and then she wrote an expose, and I realized as a feminist that there weren't any, first-person reports about prostitution. And I just thought, well, Gloria Steinem did it, and she wrote about it, and I was a writer, and I just thought, well, I could do it. And, it wasn't just that. It was also I was kind of in a desperate state financially, and my partner had broken up with me. I just moved to San Francisco. So there were many factors, but basically I started doing it just as a feminist and just to basically talk about it and to see to see what my experience was.
Now, what did you find there, Carol? What was your experience?
Well, when I started working, I went to work at a massage parlor, and I thought from all I had heard about prostitution that everyone I'd meet would be really down and out and very miserable, but I was very surprised that wasn't the case at all. I was very surprised by the women I met, and I realized since I was meeting these women, and they seemed very strong and resilient and really interesting, and they were women from all over the world, from Vietnam and from Korea, from Mexico, and I realized that perhaps the realities of prostitution were not really expressed in the public, and I felt like, well, there was more here, and I needed to explore it. And very quickly, as soon as I started working as a prostitute, I understood the meaning of whore stigma. They hadn't used that term at that point, but I understood that what it meant that there was a certain kind of a stigma around someone who has experience in this work. And I thought that that wasn't, it seemed like it wasn't very feminist that, you know, if a woman has sex for money once, she's tainted for life. I mean, to define a person by one sexual experience, that seemed very sexist. So I thought the underpinnings of all the information we have about prostitution were perhaps wrong, and I just thought I really needed to explore it. And I was very, very interested, and actually, it, you know, worked into my monetary needs. So, and my first experience in it was not problematic. I actually didn't object to having sex with strangers. I was kind of a bit of a sexual adventuress anyway. And so I embarked on what I realized was going to be my life's work.
Now, a lot of people have asked, what is a massage parlor? When you talk about a massage parlor, you know, I think there are different connotations. You know, a lot of people don't know necessarily what a massage parlor is, or maybe they're thinking of the, you know, going to the Aveda salon and getting a massage.
Well, there are a lot of different massage parlor. A lot of the massage establishments in many cities have some workers there, or many workers there who offer additional services other than massage. So there are. And this can be true in any massage establishment, but I have to say it's certainly inappropriate to offer to exchange money for sex in generally in massage businesses unless you have a pretty clear idea that that's what's going on. It's all very delicate, so to speak. But in many massage establishments, that is basically erotic massage is. Sort of is part of the business, and it's a rubric for prostitution, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone in that business is engaging in prostitution. So it is a very delicate issue because, of course, it's tenuous at each particular establishment. The existence of these places is quite tenuous, and there's a vulnerability for these businesses. Now, when I worked at this establishment, I know that I was offering sexual services. I'm not sure about everyone who was there, but I do feel that that was probably one of the most positive environments that I ever worked in. And it was certainly more positive than what I hear about in terms of the strip clubs nowadays. So I feel like there are many positive businesses in this industry, and when I work from an activist perspective, I'm interested and have worked towards empowering the workers in this industry and working to support the better businesses. But of course, you know, it's illegal in this country, so you know, one could say that this is not really something one can do and one can succeed at in you know, the most obvious ways. It's a long-term project since, of course, we have to decriminalize too. But, you know, I mean, on the other hand, quite often when I worked in the business, the massage parlor workers were employees, and there's certainly rights within the context, even within the context of the rubric.
And when you talk about employees' rights, a lot of people object to the idea of sex workers having the same employment rights. How do you speak to those people? I mean, to me it makes sense that regardless of your profession, that you should have equal protection under the law. You should have the same human labor and civil rights.
Of course. Right. I mean, I think that... you know, before this, our sex workers' rights movement has only been around since the 70s. This is really, really a new movement. I think it may be one of the newest movements, probably. The transgender rights movement is probably new as well, but it is certainly new. And I think that many people balk at calling prostitution labor. And prior to the sex worker rights movement, it was often looked at as some expression of a woman's sluttiness. So it's a kind of a perversion or depraved lifestyle. It's looked at as a lifestyle, and the idea that it would be labor was somehow, that was not consistent with the view of prostitution, that it was basically work. So I think that those who are opposed to prostitution first stop at even calling it labor. So they don't really consider the idea that there may be labor rights, because that's just simply basically not labor. It's exploitation from that perspective. It's a sort of a rape. It's about being bribed to have sex against your will. And I mean, I feel like as a feminist, I've really inspected the analysis very deeply, and I think that analysis really it makes sense it makes sense from an essentialist point of view around sexuality. If you feel that only the purest ascension and consent makes sex okay, then anything less than that direct lust and love and anything less than that is not an appropriate way to have sex. It involves some sort of coercion. And it depends on degree. So I think that having sex for, trading sex for, a place to stay, or it's all a degrees of rape, I think, from a feminist perspective. The wife trading sex for a new refrigerator could be seen as it's a form of, you bribe to do it, and you could read that as a form of sexual assault. To me, there's a definition of sex implicit in that I don't agree with. I feel that sex is complicated, the reasons that we might have sex, and that I think that we have to be able to look at all these aspects of sexuality, that it can be practiced as a barter. It's practiced sometimes for a sort of spiritual healing, and of course it's practiced as a survival strategy for poor women. It's also practiced as a means of curiosity. Basically, of course, it's mostly practiced just to get more money, whether it's by someone poor or by someone putting themselves through college. It's basically about trying to get money.
This is XBN, Swati's Broadcast Network. Powered by Blog Talk Radio. If you would like to join our show, my guest tonight is Carol Lee. You can join us at 646-200-3136. My apologies for briefly interrupting you, Carol. We have to legally do these identifications. What do you say to the feminists who say essentially what you stated, that all forms of the sex industry are rape, are sexual assault?
Well, I think... I mean, for me, a bottom line is that, again, it's important to support this work in that it is a survival strategy for individuals that are often unable to find other ways to survive. Now, of course, the idea that we should have economic justice to avoid these problematic aspects of prostitution, it's idealistic, I think it's right we should have economic justice. I certainly think that would certainly minimize or limit to some extent. If we really had economic justice, I guess it was more utopian, and we did have that, that would certainly reduce the amount of prostitution and certainly reduce the amount of problematic prostitution. War, the displacement in war causes the problematic aspects of prostitution. All the things that are problematic in general in life are problematic in prostitution, and the solutions to the world's problems are the same solutions to the problems within prostitution. So to those individuals who say, basically bottom line is that it's inherently exploitative and something we have to wipe off the face of the earth, I mean, I say that... that is not necessarily the best perspective for someone who's supporting people who are in an economic class who have no other options. And I think it's basically campaigns around criminalizing and repressing prostitution wind up affecting poor women and punishing poor women. And that includes campaigns that to repress clients and to punish clients, because certainly who it affects most is the clients of poor women, and certainly reduces their income and puts a lot more pressure on them and their communities, and doesn't give them, these women, the ability, and also men who are in the industry, doesn't give them the ability to organize, unionize, and because they are then really underground, and their business is criminalized, if not them.
And there's a lot of talk here about the Swedish model, which talks about decriminalizing the sex worker, but not the client. And one of the objections often raised, which you kind of touched on, and one of my concerns about the Swedish model, while from the outset, you know, it sounds like this pro-women, as a majority of sex workers are tend to be women, that, you know, you could say, well, wow, this is empowering for women, you know, that it's taking into effect all of the exploitation that you had covered, until it's really thought through, and that the same social and economic issues that create the demand for prostitution really are going to still be there, except you're either going to force, you know, the clients farther underground, you're going to force the clients to not hire sex workers, which, if it's a survival sex, it's taking away their ability to make money to feed their family. Or for the consenting sex worker, you know, who's making a choice to be there, essentially you're eliminating their occupation. What are your thoughts to that?
Well, you know, I mean, at this point, same in my country, for example, of course, it's illegal for the clients. That doesn't mean there's not millions of clients. So, I mean, it certainly doesn't stop clients. It may stop clients from obtaining services on the streets where they can actually conduct these stings. But just as for prostitutes, the police aren't really capable of arresting that very many clients of indoor prostitution. A sting to set up a bust like that is enormously expensive, completely out of question that they could do that. And so it doesn't work, but they can target randomly on the street, and that's where they can really make up sort of the bulk of the arrestees. And this is definitely classist. A study recently in our city found that most of the men who were arrested were men of color, often that were perceived as maybe not having English as a first language. I mean, in this city, that was the situation. So, and they were more marginal men. So the arrests of clients are also on a classist basis, and it certainly does affect the poor people. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean because more clients are arrested that less sex workers are arrested. So it doesn't at all take the pressure off the prostitutes that they're arresting the clients. And the only places where I've seen any serious campaigns to adopt the Swedish model are in countries where prostitution is legal for the prostitutes and the clients. So this campaign is used to criminalize it further, not to decriminalize it for the prostitutes. For instance, if the anti-prostitution activists began a campaign in the United States to decriminalize prostitution for the prostitutes, I would be interested to see that, and I'm waiting for the day. I'm not necessarily saying that that's something that I support, because I think we need the business to be legal in order to really achieve the safety, but I still would be very interested to see the kind of consistency in that argument, and one day, perhaps, someone will, from an anti-prostitution perspective, will actually try to decriminalize prostitution for the prostitutes in this country. I find it unlikely, because most of those who are promote this perspective usually work in outreach organizations or in service organizations that acquire their clientele, i.e. prostitutes, from through arrests. So, of course, there wouldn't be too many prostitutes volunteering to go into a transitional program, especially an anti-prostitution program with all those ramifications, if they weren't forced into it. So I'd be hard-pressed to imagine that there could be any campaign to decriminalize for the prostitutes. But again, I would be very interested to see that, and maybe that could happen. What do you think?
I'm Jill Brenneman. This is XBN, Swap East Broadcast Network, Sex Worker Rights, Sex Worker Views, and Sex Worker Voices. We represent them here on XBN. My guest is Carol Lee. You can join us. It is a local call, toll-free, if you are in New York City, 646-200-3136, or at least in part of New York City. Or you can call on your cell phone, or you could, I guess, drop a quick dime. Join us speaking with our guest, Carol Lee. She is affectionately known as the Scarlet Harlot. We are discussing issues of decriminalization, issues of labor related to sex work, the sex industry. My view as a decriminalization advocate, Carol, is that, you know, my background having come from the anti-prostitution side, and until I realized that it seemed to be just a business from that side, that their solutions really were not solutions, and a sweeping generalization. You know, I heard many sweeping generalizations, you know, all sex workers are prostituted women, and we need to rescue them, and, you know, they passed that sweeping legislation, the Trafficking and Victims Protection Act, and its subsequent anti-prostitution code, which cut off funding worldwide for things as simple as, you know, getting condoms to street-based prostitutes, because that's considered to encourage prostitution. And it is an illogical sweeping argument to me to say, well, you know, we're going to fight what is, you know, human trafficking for any reason, I think, is a terrible crime. Coercion of any type for anything is a terrible crime. But the answer to me is agency for women, agency for men, agency for transgendered in the sex industry. That I think as advocates, we're all opposed to coercion. We're all opposed to rape. You know, I ended my activism from the anti-prostitution perspective essentially over the Trafficking Victims Protection Authorization Act, because I wouldn't agree to the anti-prostitution pledge, because I wouldn't agree to stop doing harm reduction. And
oh, wow, I didn't know that.
And, you know, the basis that I faced at that time as executive director of what is now Swap East was that we were told to terminate our harm reduction counseling to cut loose our clients because some of them were still active in the industry and involved with that. And,
uh-huh.
You know, and I attended a conference in D.C. about this specific issue. And it's just,
I don't want to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead.
Well, I have to say, website, the Swap East website that I've seen, and is some of the most, it's the best resource for information about harm reduction and sex workers on the internet. I speak at various colleges, and I use this site specifically as a resource. I hope the listeners are aware of that. I'm not sure if they can check that out, but I think that certainly that site really explains the harm reduction movement, and I'm interested that you I know that your belief in harm reduction was really what kind of actually forced your original divide with the anti-prostitution movement. Is that right?
That's correct. Essentially, I was given an ultimatum in D.C. at a conference by the government. I was at a conference. The OJJ, Office of Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Conference, was run by the Department of Justice. We were given specific instructions in participation in this conference that the words sex work and the words harm reduction were off limits. And a colleague of mine at the time, who actually is quite anti-prostitution, made the mistake, I guess, in that context of saying harm reduction, and she got shut down and was told to use the word safety blankets, and I was taken outside and talked to. My whatever contributions I had made at roundtable discussions were stricken from the record. And I was given the Riot Act. You know, we were going to play ball or we were going to be excluded, and they gave the Riot Act back. I wasn't going to play ball. I wasn't going to cut our harm reduction appliances. And then, which led to a tremendous backlash on the anti-prostitution movement, which turned out well because it introduced the sex worker rights movement, and that's really where I learned after meeting with activists such as yourself and so many other activists that all of these horrific terms, like, you know, the sex worker rights movement, they're all pro-porn, they're all pro-pimp, you know, this pro-pimp lobby, this pro-trafficking lobby. Who's part of a pro-trafficking lobby? I mean, nobody other than traffickers, and nobody supports trafficking other than traffickers. We're fighting against trafficking, and they're ridiculous generalizations just to vilify us. And what I found was that the activists that were so outspoken about being anti-prostitution had gotten this anti-prostitution pledge into the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act legislation, which states an organization that works with anyone engaged in prostitution is ineligible for U.S. funds. And I realized this was a play for funds. They wanted to cut out everybody but themselves out of funding. You know, I know there's a program in San Francisco where women are mandated into, you know, they're arrested and they're mandated into this program. And you spoke some to that. I mean, as a former sex worker, did you ever face arrest, and would you have found being mandated into a program which essentially told you that what you were doing prior was wrong and how you were being oppressed, et cetera, a program that, you know, essentially you had to pay for and you were forced into, would that have been a good situation for you?
Well, I mean, of course not for me, but I mean, the whole movement of how to have diversion for sex workers, it shouldn't be illegal in the first place, of course. And then to put you in a program specifically that shames you and destroys your self-esteem is problematic. Now, some people actually can benefit from that. There can, you know, if you... I'm going to make up statistics, but out of 100 people, there may be 2 people or 3 people who thrive by being arrested and then humiliated. I can say that there's always someone. And then those people can go on and say, well, this is an excellent program. And, you know, it's really the minority of those who are arrested, well, certainly arrest is traumatic. And certainly being arrested in the first place is something that would be problematic for most people. And of course, we are in a criminalized system. We do want to find alternatives to incarceration. So, I mean, there are other options, but to be separated from other criminals, put in this shaming kind of program, which they're trying to do all over the country, saying that we're rescued, and then finding those, you know, one in or two in every how many people who do say, indeed, you know, I love the cops, thank you for arresting me. I mean, that is kind of what we're seeing these days. And, you know, ignoring the scores of those who are traumatized by arrest, whose families are victimized and broken up by arrest. And we need services before we get arrested. Services should not be tied to that arrest incident. Prostitutes are very eager to get services. We need housing. We need child care. I mean, there are so many things that you see in survey after survey that sex workers need. And sex workers care about our health. We need health programs. We don't need it attached to some kind of punishment.
And I think part of what goes unrealized by a lot of society is that, you know, the legislation that's in place in the United States, sex workers, prostitutes, exotic dancers, et cetera, you know, they don't get the access to these, you know, especially prostitution, and they don't get access to these services.
Yeah.
You know, and now they can't get access to them because there's so many funding problems created by that legislation that agencies are starving, except these rescue-based agencies and these end-demand agencies.
Well, more and more, I just think that, you know, I'm coming back to feeling that our movement is new, and although we have so many objections to the way the current, you know, criminalization is working and to the way services are being provided, that ultimately I think that this movement are really growing and expanding. I think it will inform people. I know that, you know, your average social worker certainly supports harm reduction. It's really kind of just the zealots, anti-prostitution zealots and maybe evangelicals and the, you know, the tough love evangelicals I think that basically most people do support this, and most people do see that arrest is traumatic for prostitutes. I think that it will probably be going in a good direction. Don't you think so?
I certainly do. You know, this is my third year in the sex worker rights movement, and I have never found a movement that was more accepting of diversity. You know, to give the audience and yourself a brief overview, I went to my first sex worker rights conference in 2005, and flying to Vegas to attend this conference, I was terrified. I was saying to myself, what have I gotten myself into? And I expected to be viewed, you know, with a great deal of suspicion because of my past work with the anti-prostitution movement. And, you know, I said to myself, I remembered my experiences from doing presentations of conferences from the anti-prostitution side and being told up front, you know, what I should talk about, what part of my experiences I should not talk about, how I should frame them, even to the point where there were times that I, you know, there were attempts to couch my experiences, well, maybe you should represent it in a different way than how it happened because it would make a better statement. You know, and I at first, you know, I was very new to activism. This was way before I was involved in the sex worker rights movement. It was in the late 90s. And, you know, I was kind of taken aback by this, that someone wanted me to, you know, reinvent my past to make it fit their agenda. And so when I got to the Sex Worker Rights Conference in Vegas, you know, I kind of anticipated that all conferences were like the ones that I'd seen before. And I was astonished. Everyone let me be. There wasn't distrust of me. You know, there wasn't this. No one told me I had to be or do anything. People were welcoming, and it was one of the most empowering experiences of my life to become part of the sex worker rights movement. It led to what is now SWAP East, the Sex Worker Outreach Project East chapter, which at one time was a very strongly anti-prostitution organization, and we are now a sex worker rights organization. And Carol, that has a lot to do with you, and that's why I'm very honored.
I know, I remember. So I knew. It's very exciting. Well, I remember when you wrote letters to people in the movement. You had just started kind of coming to a realization that the direction that you're working in the anti-prostitution movement was not good, and you just wrote a short letter that you were interested in talking or something like that, and I was just amazed to get it. And I was so, just to hear your experiences, and you know, I'd always felt like that. I've talked to many people who had experiences like that, but then most of those people wanted instead just to sort of lay low and keep away from any movement. That was what I'd noticed, you know. So I was, to hear that someone was reaching out to me and to other activists, I was really interested and amazed by that. So, and it always seemed like, I remember talking to you and meeting you, I could imagine where you sort of just drifted into the movement. That movement, it was a large movement, and it makes a lot of sense, and I could see how that would happen, and then maybe it would take a while to consider that maybe there was another way to look at things. Or I think you kind of always knew. That was my impression. You kind of knew, but it took a while for you to let yourself know what you were experiencing, something like that.
Well, I'll tell you part of the basis. I knew and was told up front by friends, by colleagues in the anti-prostitution movement, if I made contact with what they call, you know, the quote-unquote pro-prostitution people, you know, that was the end of friendships, relationships.
Right.
You know, I really had no idea that, you know, when I flipped the project to harm reduction, that was going to lead to death threats, and having to do, you know, a presentation under police protection because, you know, the provider, Virginians, aligned against sexual assault, who was hosting a conference at the University of Virginia, they received such strong death threats to try to silence myself and another speaker, but specifically me, you know, from a radical feminist, or at least someone who presented themselves to me, that they wanted me to not speak because they felt I was betraying the movement. And I feel that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, I personally, as an activist, wish that we could all agree to disagree, come together, at least on issues that we can agree on. But what I found was the sex worker rights movement, people such as yourself, were very open to that. But from the other side, they weren't. You know, there's this complete demonization.
It took
me time to, you know, first I'd heard all, you know, the horrific things of pro porn and blah, 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 etc. And then when I started making the changes in the organization, you know, came what really shocked me, the long-time friendship ended, and there wasn't even a willingness to look at the sex worker rights perspective. I was a heretic. But I'm glad it happened, Carol. I mean, we've blossomed into a much more vibrant organization, and I've come into such a wonderful sex worker rights movement. I have to do my station identification thing again. This is XBN, Swappies Broadcast Network on Blog Talk Radio. My guest is Kelly Lee. She is the Scarlet Harlot. Please do call in. Carol is a wonderful guest. I'm sure she would love to take your call. You can call us at area code 646-200-3136. 646-200-3136. This is XBN. Carol, tell us about your book.
My book? Unrepentant Whore, Collected Work of Scarlet Harlot, and it's on Amazon, and it's kind of an activist journal. It starts with some memoir that's kind of entertaining and interesting. It's about my struggles as a feminist, and it has a chapter about coining the term sex work, how that came about. It's an activist history, though, really. It's more of an activist journal. It has various essays I've written about specific issues. It really chronicles some of the activist work rather than focusing on the sex work, although there is some portrayal of my encounters with clients. It really focuses on my work as an activist and just really the beginnings of my work as an activist, although I guess it covers about 20 years or so. I would hope people would get it on Amazon and take a look, write to me. I know that young activists have read it and they found it inspiring, and I know that, you know, I mean, it's definitely entertaining reading, but it's also edifying, and I just talk about some of the strategies we used back then, and I think that can be... That's important for current sex worker activists to see what's been done, what directions we need to go in. You know, although the current movement is very inspiring. I know SWAP USA and Robin Few really invigorated this movement. It was in 2003 that she began organizing SWAP USA. So. I know the new, younger activists have a whole new world out there and so many skills, and it's very exciting the kinds of the things they're doing with media and with community organizing. Speaking of that and the conference issue, you know, we, of course, as you know, we're having a conference in Chicago in July 16th through 20th. So it's a chance for people to actually get involved. I would definitely invite them to attend this conference. We try to keep it as affordable as possible. I don't know about how many scholarships we have this year, but we do have some scholarships. We very much support diverse perspectives and participation and communities represented, so that's really important to us. And it also very much includes academic perspectives, so we definitely support activists, academics, sex workers, everyone to come. So they can look at this material at DesireeAlliance.org. They can probably just put sex worker conference in Google, but Desiree Alliance, Desiree, I guess people know how to spell that, DesireeAlliance.org, and they'll be able to find out all about the conference and sign up. And we have already received our proposals for panels, but I'm just going to be bad and tell people to submit a late one and then don't say I told you to. Is that okay? No, probably not, because I got no approval for that. Anyway, it's supposed to be closed, but yeah, submit one anyway if you have a panel idea. You never know.
I totally agree. You know, I know one of the activists involved in the panel, and she may even be a listener right now, and she's probably thinking of ways to strangle me. but having submitted late proposals in the past and having them accepted, it probably will work out.
I guess so. Don't tell them that we said so, okay?
You can. You know. Well, what I found about yesterday, which I didn't know, the Blog Talk Radio was on a 10-second delay, so you know, if there's a monitor listening, they can edit that out and within your 10 seconds and
okay.
get in trouble. And once again, please feel that you can call us at XBN 646-200-3136. You can also participate via email. Our email address is xbnlive@gmail.com. You can send your questions in. You can call in. We have a wonderful guest. You know, she essentially coined the term sex worker, and you know, she is certainly one of my heroes.
Awesome.
Which is on my MySpace page, it definitely states that, much to the chagrin of some others. You had talked about Robin Few, and Robin Few is herself is a controversial figure. You know, she's quite well known as a patriotic prostitute for asking, if I understand correctly, for asking for her, she had been arrested and asked for her sentence to be delayed so that she could vote for Measure Q to decriminalize prostitution. And Robin is vilified, you know, as this evil pro-trafficking. And Robin's a sweetheart, you know, and it horrifies me to see some of the things that are said about Robin, about you, about all of us, you know. Our movement is about rights, and I would guess, Carol, that you are as opposed to coercion and to rape and to trafficking as anyone. How do you speak?
You know, I mean, what drives me crazy is that we even have to say that. I mean, it's so obvious and clear. I mean, you know, it's funny because I was writing a press release, and I don't recall about an issue around, I don't even remember what it was. We were protesting deportation of local sex workers here, and I think I was writing maybe one page, and as people were reviewing it, people on our side were reviewing it. They basically made sure that every single paragraph had to say, had to have one sentence at least that said that we were opposed to rape and abuse and forced prostitution. I mean, not just once in the press release, but every paragraph had at least needed at least, I mean, probably this is hyperbole, but every paragraph needed at least one sentence that said that. I mean, it's really like that. And you wouldn't think that I would be sitting down with some, you know, other progressive, normally reasonable person who would actually ask me, I mean, this is a different discussion, but I'm saying who would actually even intimate that I wouldn't say, of course I'm against rape and forced prostitution. I mean, it's just so bizarre at this point. But, you know, on the other hand, discussing what the problems are with the anti-trafficking framework is very complicated. And The anti-trafficking framework is very old. You know, as we know, that was the campaigns from the 1800s were what's responsible for much of the criminalization of prostitution in this country and around the world. So these sorts of concerns and campaigns have been central to repression and criminalization of prostitution. And now how to revisit this issue and inform people about that history, the dangers of how this emphasis can be used to criminalize the work. It's a very difficult task, and it's a complicated issue. And I think that, you know, it's in some ways the discussion is more sophisticated than most people are ready for in terms of a discussion even about sexuality. I mean, it's a new age. We see, you know, so much sex on TV, but people are still only beginning to talk honestly about sexuality. So it's sophisticated.
Now, Carol, we've got an email. Jeff, who is attending the University of Kentucky, he writes that he is unfamiliar with the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. But he asked you specifically, what would you oppose about protecting trafficking victims?
Well,
do you have an answer to that?
Let's see. Well, let me see. It was in the late 90s that many friends of mine who are human rights activists came together because they saw that there was an issue in Eastern Europe wherein women from the former Soviet bloc countries were suddenly seen on the streets of various other European countries doing prostitution, and they found that when they were doing prostitution, and sometimes there were some exploitative conditions. Now, they saw that the European countries were then starting to look at anti-immigration laws in order to get rid of these prostitutes. They were also looking at the fact that there was some abuse in the arrangements that these prostitutes from Russia had in their efforts to travel and work. So this is trafficking. There was some coercion, some exploitation in these contexts. So these people I know had started an organization, the Foundation, I think Foundation for Women and Global Alliance Against Traffic in Women. I'm not sure which came first. And these organizations were trying to make sure that those women who did have problems in trafficking were not just deported and were not subjected to stricter immigration laws, but that the countries would rally to the cause and actually help the victims who were subjected to all these abusive conditions. So this movement also saw that there were other industries that were affected by the disintegration of the Soviet bloc. And in fact, they thought there were commonalities. And they came up with something that was quite new, which was a new definition for trafficking. Now, previously, trafficking only meant, of course, there's trafficking in drugs, guns, but in terms of migration, it really only referred to prostitution. And these human rights activists in the 90s realized that the former anti-trafficking movements, referring only to prostitution, were used as a means to repress prostitution in general, and certainly had no interest in other kinds of forced labor, and no interest in ensuring the safety of sex workers as they traveled. So they came up with a new definition that was ultimately incorporated into the UN protocol, defining trafficking as basically anyone who traveled, who was involved in forced or coerced in the context of their work. And these activists did that in order to, you know, first of all, emphasize that all forced labor in migration needs to be addressed. And second of all, to not stigmatize the sex workers and not have this movement used as a tool to repress prostitution. So there was a big fight at the UN. The anti-prostitution activists came to the UN and said, no, we want, indeed, we do think that the existence of trafficking should be used as a point and a tool against prostitution, because indeed trafficking only exists because of prostitution, and that they to some extent accepted the new definition in the UN protocol. But they also felt that it was very reasonable that all prostitution be considered trafficking, that because you couldn't consent to prostitution, because the idea is that all prostitution is a form of rape, because you don't really want to do it, you're just doing it for the money. So basically all prostitution is forced labor. So they wanted the trafficking concerns to focus on criminalizing prostitution further and repressing the industry. So, however, at the UN, I mean, there was sort of a compromise, but I must say that the broader definition of trafficking was adopted. This is a very complicated issue, so there's a caveat there, but I think that you need to look at my trafficking policy research project. You can Google that and get the full story. So then the anti-prostitution activists came back to the United States and then tried to dismantle that definition in the U.S. Trafficking Victims Protection Act, and tried to then bring back the definition of trafficking to mean to focus on prostitution. And so the kind of long answer, what sorts of differences would I see in the trafficking, in the approach to services for trafficking victims? Well, one of the things I think the anti-prostitutes rights, the anti-prostitution activists agree, I mean, no one wants to force those who are who say that they are trafficked to testify against traffickers. They basically, if someone migrates and is in a problematic situation, we don't want them to be forced to put their family in jeopardy and to testify. There's a lot of pressure on them for that, and it really doesn't work. So we want them to be able to get services nonetheless. And I think that's very central to our complaints. So services are important. I personally have a big problem with the idea that you can't work at all in the sex industry. If you've been trafficked and you, perhaps you were trafficked only insofar as you come here knowing you were going to be a prostitute, but you were in an abusive situation. Well, of course, in this country, you can't work as a prostitute after you say you're a trafficking victim. I don't think you can even work as a stripper. I guess I understand that. In countries where it's legal, though, I do think that you should be able to still work in the industry if it's legal, even though you've run into a bad circumstance. If you want to still work in the industry, you should be able to. That's a difference. These are very complicated differences. But the main problem I have with the way the Trafficking Victims Protection Act works is that it has funds to shame clients. Now, I think that's harmful and inappropriate. I think that the Trafficking Victims Protection Act should focus on giving resources to those who are victims, on support and empowerment, but to have every client of a prostitute then be subjected to various sorts of shaming programs. I think that's a very problematic use of the funds and the organization of the anti-trafficking efforts in this country. And they call that, they're attacking demand. Well, they're talking about demand for sex work in general, not just demand for, sex slaves, which that's another long topic. The other thing I think that's problematic is that in the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, as you were saying, Jill, there's an anti-prostitution loyalty oath that any organization that wants to help prostitutes has to sign an oath that they won't support their kind of empowerment strategies. They won't support, legal sex work, etc. I think that's extremely problematic, and I think that certainly in many other countries there are great campaigns for empowerment and for legal prostitution. And to say that that organizations that are helping prostitutes can't have any of those ideas in their midst, that's highly problematic. So, I can go sort of point by point into what's problematic about our laws. Also, there's another new bill, and that's on my website too, H.R. 3887 in the House, that changes the jurisdiction of the FBI to have to have surveillance and an authority over prostitution all over the country, even interstate. It's sort of by a stretch, but it's in there. You have to look closely. You have to look at my website. So basically, the basic problem I have with the way that the Trafficking Victims Protection Act is organized is that it's basically the thrust of it, instead of looking at the wealth of problems of forced labor in this country and around the world, only 11% of which is in the sex industry, if I recall, almost only looking at sex industry problems, and it's focusing on voluntary aspects of the sex industry. So, did I say it?
I think you did a great job.
Okay. What does Jeff say? If he has another question, maybe then I'll know if I made it clear.
Well, let's see if we can get some callers.
Okay.
You can join us at 646 23136. My name is Jill Brenneman. My guest is Carol Lee. This is XBN, Swap East Broadcast Network. Swap East, you can reach us at www.swopeast.org. We are powered by Blog Talk Radio, and to get our legal definitions in, this transmitted broadcast originates in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. Once again, the listener lines are open, 646-200-3136. I guess you've answered Jeff's question. Thank you. Did not.
Why, he didn't write back?
I did not see Jeff.
Okay.
Certainly we would love some calls if you would like to call in. Carol, what else would you like to, you know, let me throw you a ball, what topic would you like that we haven't covered?
For me, or is that a general question for the listener?
Yeah, that's for you.
Oh, for me. What topic haven't we covered? Well, Well, wait a minute. It's we did it. It's 4 o'clock here. Well, it's 6 o'clock there, right?
It is. We are coming right up on the closure of the show.
It's perfect because I feel like we've covered most things. We didn't cover arts. We didn't cover the huge amount of sex workers, including, I guess, this is Kristen from, but that's not her name. I'm sorry, I forgot her name. But but the vast amount of artists supporting themselves in this industry and the arts festivals, the sex worker arts and cultural festivals. I have a music video at sexworkerfest.com/trouble. Trouble. It's, you can just put, probably Google it, Courtney Troubles. Music video, sex worker rights music video by Courtney Trouble. So it's probably best to Google. It's on Blip TV, and it's a great music video. People probably like it, but sex worker arts is important, and I do a lot of cultural work, so I think that's exciting for people.
You know, I spoke in a presentation last evening, and at William and Mary. Williamsburg, Virginia, and there was this great controversy there. They had invited the Sex Workers Art Show, and the Sex Workers Art Show had done...
I performed there with the Sex Workers Art Show.
So my understanding is there was a great deal of outcry and protest, and so they brought me there last night to kind of what was stated was that by the people who objected, and you know, the university's funding was threatened over the Sex Workers Art Show, and there ended up being, you know, forced resignation with the university personnel and political pressure on activists to not bring the Sex Workers Art Show. And the critics there, you know, they stated that they would feel much more comfortable if the issue was presented in a lecture setting, and so they, William and Mary, and this wonderful activist named Constance Fisk, she brought me up to William and Mary yesterday, and we did this lecture presentation, and part of it actually was aired live on the show, and it's archived at Blog Talk Radio. .com/SwapEast. And one of the great ironies was that not a single critic showed up. And there was even discussion on the campus newspaper, some very derogatory statements made about the Sex Workers Art Show and about my presentation. You know, these were written prior. And I, prior to the presentation, I even invited the person making the derogatory comments to come up to me tap into the show and introduce themselves, or to, you know, come to me during during the question and answer phase of the presentation, and feel free to ask any question they wanted to, and they no-showed. I kind of got the sense that a lot of people wanted to protest just for the sake of being heard, banging the drums loudly, but when it came time to actually talk about the issue, there was nobody there, and the people who were there, you know, we had a significant crowd, and they were very receptive of the sex worker show, and, you know, some of them expressed concerns, expressing concerns at the outset about sex worker rights, but by the end of the presentation and the end of the live broadcast afterward, they said that they had a lot of cause to rethink. You know, they hadn't thought about it that way. So I think the Sex Workers Art Show and all of the activism that you're doing, that Robin Fee is doing, that everyone is doing, you know, it's building a movement and creating awareness. And I think there's a lot more support out there once we clear, you know, these ridiculous misconceptions that exist. And once we clear the propaganda campaign against our movement by, you know, a faction of the feminist anti-prostitution movement that is using their power and influence with the Bush administration, you know, ostensibly to help trafficking victims, but really just, really leads more that they want to keep the funding for themselves, because our voices contradict a lot of their points.
Uh-huh.
And if our voices are heard, then the legislation may change and they lose their funding stream. I'm certain that they would disagree with that. But essentially, having been on the inside of that movement and now being on a sex worker rights movement and, you know, being villainized as all of you have, then it kind of becomes apparent that that's a business for many of them. And it's a great way to get well-funded organizations and high-paying jobs in the government. But I really feel like as a movement or a human rights movement, and that we are making great strides, you know, and this started with activists such as yourself, you know, who came out of the anti-war movement. You know, for listeners who may be younger, this came out of the Vietnam War activism, for many activists. I guess in wrapping up our show, once again, we'll open it up for one more time for questions. 646-200-3136, this is FBM, Swapies Broadcast Network. I'm Jill Brenneman. My guest is Carol Lee, the Scarlet Harlot, the author of The Unrepentant Whore. And please check out the book. It's a wonderful book. Yeah, it's a great book about activism. I think we'll give maybe 1 or 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And to see if anybody wants to call in to add to the show or to ask any questions. I realize that we have kept you over the allotted time, and I'm greatly thankful to you for staying with the show and giving us extra time, Carol. Well, we had a caller briefly, but they dropped off, which this is new technology. This is powered by Blog Talk Radio. Well, I guess we will conclude the program, Carol.
Right.
I want to thank you so much for joining our program, to
thank
welcome
you.
You to join us once again at any time as a guest. I would love to have you back on XBN, Swapies Broadcast Network. And I guess in conclusion, please check out Carol Lee. Google her on the web, look for her work. She's a wonderful activist and a wonderful woman, and for activists and for activists and social rights causes, her work is an inspiration. My name is Jill Brenneman. This program has been XBN, the Sex Workers Outreach Project Broadcast Network. Our shows are archived. You can download this show and listen at a future date if you choose to do so, or you can play it back. You can do so at www.blogtalkradio.com/swap, SWOP East. My name is Jill Brenneman. Point of origination of this broadcast is Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. This is XBN.
Chapter takes place in the middle of the night with no sunshine.
XBN, Sloppy's Broadcast Network, music by the Naked Heroes from Brooklyn. Prior to that, Liz Berlin, Rusted Root. Liz Berlin is also a great solo artist from her album Autobiographical. This concludes our broadcast. This is XBN, Sloppy's Broadcast Network, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. XBN on Talk Radio.
All I had to do was ask. I can't believe it. Life is moving through me way too fast. I can't believe it. You mean all I had to do was ask, and now my life has shifted. And now my life has changed in way too many ways. To be able to go the other way.
This is XBN, Swappies Broadcast Network. I really wish the Swappies Broadcast Network switchboard had a fade button. Blog Talk Radio has not empowered that yet. The artist, we are very grateful at Swappies and XBN for Liz Berlin. Liz Berlin is well known from the rock group Rusted Root. She is also a fantastic solo artist. The song is from her album Autobiographical, and we are very grateful for her gracious allowance for us to use her music. My name is Jill Brenneman. XBN is on the air for the next half hour. We are more than happy to take your calls at 646-200-3136. The topic is the democratic freedoms quashed in Peru. We received a letter, as XBN and Swappies are friends and supporters of Lori Berenson. You can get information on who Lori Berenson is at www.freelori.org. Once again, it's www.freelori.org. It's a great website. It talks about how she was wrongfully imprisoned. To give you a little bit of background, Lori Berenson is a young woman. She is held a political prisoner in Peru. Lori is a U.S. citizen. She was arrested in the 90s for a really bizarre conviction of treason, even though she is not a citizen of Peru. That was eventually overturned. However, she is still being held as a political prisoner. Her conviction for treason against the government of Peru and the life sentence she received under the regime of President Fujimori, those were overturned. In June 2001, she was cleared of terrorism-related charges, but she was convicted of collaboration and sentenced to 20 years in prison in a trial that the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights claimed completely violated her human rights. Swappies very much supports Lori Berenson and Lori's work. And thus, for the next half hour, we're going to talk about a recent press release from Lori Berenson and what she is working on, what's happening in the country of Peru. You are welcome to join in on the discussion. 646-200-3136. Once again, my name is Joan Brenneman. And to give you information on what is happening in the country of Peru, the press release from the organization that supports Laurie Berenson and her freedom, Democratic Freedom's Request in Peru, a call for action. Today in the mainstream Peruvian newspaper, El Comercio, the Peruvian writer, Mario Vargas Llosa, demonstrates that even novelists of his stature can easily confound fact and fiction, incredibly at a moment when democratic freedoms in Peru are being trampled, and Peru's behavior towards those who protest seems to be modeled after China. Vargas Llosa absurdly heaps praise on the Peruvian president, Alan Garcia, his first 20 months in office, perhaps because he is an Argentiner. Vargas Llosa is not in tune with the realities that have occurred in his country. Last week, Mark Berenson, where his father had been, and Lori in her prison at Udacruz, or Udacariz prison, which is located in the rural city of Cajamarca, Peru. Not since the first year of this millennium, when the Fujimori dictatorship fell from power, have democratic principles been so disregarded. Only a handful of journalists and political analysts have even mentioned this. Inexplicably, the Peruvian human rights and religious communities have also been silent. Only one international human rights organization, Rights Action, on March 23rd, has alerted the public about the ongoing human rights problem. In a letter below that Lori wrote on March 21st, based on Peruvian news reports, she asked for your help in notifying international human rights organizations to pressure Peruvian human rights community not to remain silent any longer, to stand up for the preservation of democratic freedoms. All of the information Lori has provided in her letter is taken from the Peruvian press, the Peruvian radio, and other sources that can easily be referenced. However, when you contact any international human rights organization, it would be better to acknowledge Rights Action as the source, since this is Peruvian human rights community. I question Lori's legitimacy and use this as an excuse to remain silent. The letter from Lori Berenson reads, since dated March 21st, Dear friends, greetings from Northern Peru. Hoping all is well with you and your loved ones, and thanking you for your continued interest in my situation. Once again, you can find out more about Lori Berenson at www.freelori.org. Since his inauguration, Lori states further in her letter, in July 2006, I have felt incredible frustration observing Peruvian President Alan Garcia's management of the country. It is hard to realize what is happening unless you see through the day-to-day insidious manipulation of public opinion that is unleashed in a rather special way, since the Garcia administration is largely backed by all of the major media entities, newspapers, magazines, radio, and television stations in Peru. However, negative events have indeed been happening. An increasingly serious inflation, which hunts that the population is not supposed to realize are occurring because the government uses smokescreens. Rather, in this period of increasing social unrest, for diverse reasons, the Garcia administration is trying to remind people of the bullets and bombs, days of intense political violence that occurred in the late 1980s and early 1990s, in order to justify that there must be unity in the country and that nobody has the right to think differently from the official government position. Dissent and political opposition are viewed not as normal expressions of democratic process, but rather as treasonous terrorist tactics intended to destabilize the Peruvian country. Examples of this: several months ago, new legislation by executive decree was passed that increases the lengths and sentences given for supposed crimes committed by those who dare to protest. In addition, Peru's armed forces and police will even impunity for deaths they may cause during actions while on duty, including while quelling protests. A few weeks ago, four agrarian protesters were shot dead. Last week, seven protesters were wounded, and the commanding general of that region blamed the incident on a terrorist group information, a statement vigorously denied by the protest organizers. In late February, several people were detained, and warrants for the detention of others were issued because they were alleged to belong to a leftist political organization that exists throughout Latin America, but does not carry out illicit activities in Peru or anywhere else, whatever ideological affiliation you may have. Perhaps not unrelated, yet a third congressional commission has now been formed to investigate Casas del Alba, a non-governmental organization with a link to Venezuela that exists throughout Peru. This non-governmental organization is an organization that offers social programs such as medical assistance to Peru's poor, but ever since the presidential campaign of 2006, when Hugo Chavez, the Venezuelan president, supported the opposition leader, the Venezuelan president has been painted by the Garcia administration as an evil force in the Western Hemisphere. The NGO, non-governmental organization, has also been accused of promoting ideological interventions of Peru's sovereignty and other peculiar depictions. On and off, there have been media campaigns demanding the publication of a list of all ex-detainees, all ex-prisoners who've been jailed for terrorism. The latter list would violate a constitutional principle that incarceration is a form of rehabilitation. Theoretically, once a sentence has been served, the person can no longer be seen as a different person by anyone else. A widely watched television program dedicated a special report, obviously with government intelligence information, to denounce the fact that ex-political prisoners were working together in legally constituted enterprises as though they were committing a crime. Clearly, the intent was to convince the Peruvian public that crime. Narco-trafficking incidents were reported regularly, but are always identified with the orally abused word terrorism, connecting these so-called to terrorist groups. From the very first days of the Garcia administration, well, we see it as the possibility that political persecution of key opposition, now the narrowly defeated presidential candidate, is about to be put on trial, and many believe this is retribution. There are reports indicating that Hernan Fuentes, a democratically elected president of the region of Puno, is seeking political asylum because the Garcia administration is threatening his removal from office, charging him with treason or sedition for suggesting that the poor and undersupported region to be granted autonomy. It seems the Garcia administration fears that the people may now hold different political views from those of his spouses. With all the political events reported above, any reference to Peru as a currently participatory democracy must be viewed as highly questionable. It is indeed ironic that one of the only persons to call attention to democratic malpractice in Peru is conservative writer Alberto M. Andrade from La Republica, who in his article Dissidencia del Macartismo Peruano argues that Peru is becoming a McCarthy-type state, referring to the United States in the early 1950s. Unaccountably, Peruvian human rights community has remained silent on these abuses of the democratic process. Lord Berenson would like to ask those of you who associate with human rights organizations working on an international level to express these concerns and ask that your organizations urge their counterparts in Peru and these organizations are listed at www.fabory.org. Speak out. This is something that needs to be debated on a national level. It can't just be the concerns expressed by someone like Roy, who is considered to be a terrorist because of these dangerous diseases that affect the well-being of a democratic society. Witch hunts are not intended to be part of a democratic process. The right to disagree, and the right to dissent, and the right to have whatever ideology, the right to assemble, the right to protest, all intrinsic to any real democracy. But these rights have been marginally prohibited here in Peru, right, Gloria Berenson. People should not continue to be detained, punished, or even killed for exercising their democratic rights. Gloria writes further, I thank you for your support and feel united with you in the search for a more just world. She would greatly appreciate anything that can be done to make Peru is democracy real, with faith in a more just and humane world. Ending, Lori Berenson. Lori asks that you contact various international organizations, human rights groups. You can do that. One of them is Amnesty International USA. They're located at 5 Penn Plaza, New York, New York, 10001. You can contact them at 212-807-8400. You can contact Human Rights Watch, 350 Fifth Avenue, 34th floor, New York, New York. You can contact them at 212-290-4700. You can also contact the Washington office on Latin America. They're located at 1630 Connecticut Avenue. Northwest, Suite 200, Washington, D.C. You can call them at 202-797-2171. Latin American Working Group, 124 C, that's C, like Charlie Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C., 20002. You can also call them at 202-546-7010. Or the Council on Hemisphere Affairs, 1250 Connecticut Avenue Northwest, Suite 1C, Washington, D.C., 20036. Their telephone number is 202-223-4975. Talking points that you can use, Tom Garcia is Democratic New York, the Caribbean of Peru. These are background, actually. Peruvian media is filled with articles that indicate serious breaches of the democratic process by the Garcia administration. Peruvian human rights community has remained inexplicably silent. Examples, people have been shot, some killed, by both military and police for protesting. Military and police have been given impunity for illegal actions while on duty. People have been arrested for their ideological beliefs without having committed any crime. Ex-political prisoners are being arrested. The right to protest is not being respected. Actions that you can take, request that your human rights organization contact their Peruvian counterparts, encourage them to speak out against further erosion of democratic rights in their country. Please place an emphasis that people should not be persecuted for their political views. People should not be detained, jailed, or even killed because they exercise the right to protest. People should enjoy the right to speak, to dissent, to have political ideology, to assemble in a protest in a country that practices democracy. You can get more information about this and other information regarding Lori Berenson at www.freelori.org. The listener lines are open to discuss this issue at 646-200-3136. SWAP East, Sex Workers Outreach Project, is a strong advocate of the release of Lori Berenson, as this is a human rights issue. Can we support her just cause in fighting for the human rights in Peru and other nations worldwide? Once again, you can join our discussion at area code 646-200-3136. You can visit the website, Free Lori, that's F-R-E-E-Lori, L-O-R-I, .org. It's a great activist cause. It's one that I've personally been active in nearly since the days that Lori was taken prisoner in Peru. Her trial, her original trial, was done by hooded judges. This was under the Fujimori regime. There was hope the democratic process could bring about justice for Lori Berenson, that did not transpire. SWAP East has repeatedly written to United States senators, the United States president, requesting that they intercede on Lori Berenson's behalf, without any, so much as any response from the senators in North Carolina, the senators in Arizona, or from the president. One would have to guess that this has a lot to do with Lori's perceived political ideology as being leftist and thus being against U.S. policy, which is grossly distorted. Lori is a human rights activist, and as a human rights activist myself, it's horrifying to see what is happening in Peru, in many nations, and even in the United States, where there has been such a shift to a conservative agenda since 9/11, and where dissension is almost viewed as unpatriotic. You can call in 646-200-3136. You can check out SWAP East at SWOPEAST.org. SWAP East also has a project called Pledging Action, as we are involved in humanitarian issues in Latin America. Pledging Action is a condom distribution project for sex workers in Chile. We work with organizations in Valparaíso, Inca del Mar, and Santiago. We collect condoms strictly on our own as sex workers and sex worker rights advocates, and we ship these and spend, as we are not a funded organization, to Chile, to organizations there that can distribute them to sex workers on the street who do not have access to these, in large part due to funding restrictions placed by the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, which has an anti-prostitution pledge, which denies funding to organizations that work with working prostitutes, as that is viewed as empowering prostitution and collaborating with human trafficking. Actually, it is a harm reduction project. Because no one's life should be placed at risk, and no one should have to be at risk of dying of a horrible disease simply because we cannot get access to the most basic prevention, such as a condom. Once again, the listener lines on 646-200-3136. My name is Jill Brenneman. This is SVN, Sex Workers Outreach Project, Broadcast Network. All of our shows are archived. They're archived at blogtalkradio.com/swapeast. WOPEAST. Our music is provided generously by musician Liz Berlin, who's both a solo musician with an album called Autobiographical. Liz Berlin also has a live album, and by the rock group The Naked Heroes, based out of Brooklyn, New York, both of which generously allow us to play their music on our show. The remainder of the show will be their music. This is XBN. My name is Jill Brennan, and thank you for joining us for this broadcast on Leg Berenson. This is Goon Hand, Naked Hero, on XBN. I
Next chapter, please. I could be the character. I could hold the key. The sun don't shine in this here chapter. This chapter takes place in the middle of the night with no sun to shine.
XBN, Swappy Broadcast Network, Liz Berlin. The song is called Monster. Just prior to that, Brooklyn, The Naked Heroes. My name is Jill Brenneman. This is XPN, a service of Swapies Media. Swapies Media is from Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We encourage sex worker rights artists, sex worker artists, and those who support human rights to please submit your music in MP3s if you would love to use your music on our show. You can do that by contacting Swapies. Visit our website at www.swopest.org. This is XBN. My name is Jill Brenneman. Join us tomorrow night for another XBN broadcast.
Love Talk Radio.